We all know the Jaws scale, and it works just fine for most movies. Jaws for an excellent film. Jaws 2 for an above-average film. Jaws 3 for an okay film. And Jaws 4 for a bad movie. But Alfred Hitchcock's body of work has demanded that we create new classifications, the Psycho Scale. As Hitchcock's best-known film, which just happens to have several sequels, Psycho sets the pace. The Psycho Scale has the same ranges as the Jaws Scale. But we wouldn't want the master of suspense to feel like he's being disrespected.
Under Capricorn, starring Ingrid Bergman, Joseph Cotten, Michael Wilding, Margaret Layton.
Hope you haven't been giving too much thought to what I said about Mr. Day and her ladyship in her bedroom. I'm sure it wasn't her fault. She wasn't what you'd call responsible at the time. I know she wasn't, because she had half her clothes off and didn't seem to notice.
I wouldn't go in there, Sam. I tell you, she's had a triumph. You mustn't spoil it. Spoil it? I see. I'm not good enough to stand beside my wife when she's with the quality.
Don't be ridiculous, Sam. You aren't even dressed for a ball.
Sam. What a shock you gave me. Sir Richard, may I present my husband? Oh, you're talking about horses. I was telling His Excellency
that I was brought up in a stable. I heard you. Well, my money's as good as the next man's. The compliments of Mr. Samson Flusky, Esquire. It'll pay for my wife's supper.
Under Capricorn, the story of a strange and fascinating woman and the two men in her life.
You bloody murdering jet!
Bergman. Beautiful. Tortured.
Sam! Sam!
What's the matter? What is it?
Have you sent this woman here to kill me?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Psycho? I'm Paul Spataro, and I am joined by our usual Is It Psycho crew. So that would include Mr. Sean Whalen.
It is a pleasure to be here, gentlemen.
It is a pleasure. Mr. Trey Hooks.
Hello.
Hello, Mr. Blaine Miller.
Hello, everyone.
So today we are covering 1949 movie Under Capricorn. And, you know, one thing that has kind of come to me in this Hitchcock retrospective that we're doing is, well, it is borne out that I am a fan of Hitchcock's movie making and many of his top movies. I am much less learned in his total filmography than I thought I was. You know, I do realize he had a huge filmography and that I, you know, had only hit the tip of the iceberg. But there are a lot of movies, such as Under Capricorn, that I was totally ignorant of and had no background whatsoever that I needed to figure out what's going on to some extent. This is one of those I don't think I ever even heard of Under Capricorn before Blaine said that this is the next one we're doing. So, you know, I got it from the library and I watched it the other day, and I will hold back my thoughts on it for the time being. But it is very, very different from what I expect from Hitchcock. And again, it just points out to me how I don't know it nearly as much as I thought I did about the mystery of suspense. Let's go through and get everybody's experience with this movie. Sean?
Yeah, this was my first viewing, and really, I didn't, like you, I didn't know about this film before we were going to do it. Actually, that's part of what I enjoy about it. Doesn't matter how you feel about the film. It's great to be able to watch movies that you hadn't seen before, that you didn't know from a director. And this was definitely one of those experiences for me. There's a lot I want to talk about with, especially some of the acting talent in this one. But this is going to be, I think, a very fun conversation.
Greg?
First time for me as well. I was familiar with the title, but had never seen it before. And I'll hold my ultimate thoughts, but I will say this is not the film that I thought it was going to be. I thought this was going to be more like Sabotage, kind of more of one of the foreign intrigue type films, and it's not, but.
All right. Blaine, what do you say? You're the one, of the four of us, you're the one who I would think maybe you saw this before.
Yeah, this actually may be a little bit telling of my rating, but I remember thinking, oh, I'm glad this came up. I could finally get around to cracking that DVD and checking it out. Sat down to watch it, and some of the opening shots seemed familiar, but just those opening shots, I figured, okay, I probably saw those somewhere else. Movie wrapped up. I went to go to Letterboxd where I was saying, how am I going to rate this? I've got it narrowed down to 2 over 4 possible scores. Went to log it and found out I watched it 4 years ago and had no memory of doing so. So that's a little telling, I think.
Yeah, I'm not gonna bury the lead on this one. I was disappointed with this movie. I really didn't care for it, and I'm gonna give just a basic overview of it. I found it to be speechy, dialogue filled. I found the performances to be a little over the top and melodramatic, which is also what I found the soundtrack to be. This movie, I had to fight to stay interested in this, and I think this is one of the movies that if we weren't reviewing it on the show, I might have turned it off about halfway through and said, I don't need to see this one. Any thought?
Yeah, I can see that. It was marketed as yet another thriller, but that's not what this film is. And Hitchcock actually regretted making it. It was at a time when Ingrid Bergman was the top star in Hollywood. Everyone was trying to get her, and he realized he could with the independent production. So he grabbed Ingrid Bergman and got the kind of story she wanted to do. There is, when they say there is a mystery element, but there's no detective work. There's no deduction. It's, to me, it's not a mystery. We have two characters who share a secret until one of them just says it out loud.
It didn't even seem like all that much of a secret to me because it seemed pretty obvious. Like I didn't need clues. It was like, you know, okay, you know, this is where this movie will dramatically go. And I didn't think Hitchcock gave us many clues, but I was not surprised at all to find out the ultimate secret.
It's not a mystery, but it is gothic. And one of the things that Hitchcock does do well, I don't think he did it often, but Hitchcock does do gothic well. So if he had just veered a little bit more into that, I think this would have been a stronger film. But you have the mad woman, you have the sinister housewife, you have the isolated house, so all of the gothic trappings are there.
There's certain things in this that were telegraphed that I mean, you just knew, like especially like things that were going on with Millie and stuff like that were telegraphed, but there were some things I thought they did with character in this that I found intriguing, particularly like the switch as far as Joseph Cotton's character Sam. I felt one way about him the first half of the film. And then there comes a point with a reveal with him where now all of a sudden I'm rooting for him, which I did not see happening in the film. I thought he was going to be the, like, very much a villain type character for me, or at least an unsympathetic character. And I was going to be much more into the Michael Wilding relationship with Ingrid Bergman. And by a certain point in the film, that switches drastically for me. And I did like that part of it. There's some things about this film that worked for me that were so that, and that it's the character piece where they didn't stick to my expectations. And I like being surprised. I like when there's a shift. And I think it was a genuine shift.
I'm on the same page, Sean. You, you thought at first that this was going to be the Michael Wilding character saving Ingrid Bergman, and expected Joseph Cotten to be abusive, and then you find out, no, this is just a relationship that's under attack from all sides. There's something insidious inside trying to sabotage their relationship, and Michael Wilding becomes one more pressure against it.
And I felt the compassion between the two of them. Like, we had Ingrid Bergman's character and Michael Wilding's character. The two of them, like, there was a chemistry there. And and it so totally was building, like, you're going to be rooting for the two of them to wind up together at the end because of their shared history in the past together, but also the fact that he was definitely smitten with her, and she was with him due to that past fondness. To take that in a film and then switch it where I actually believed she was still in love with Sam, not guilt. There is a guilt portion between their relationship, but also adding a layer into that where I'm like, oh, these two love each other. They really do. When the chips are down and you cut through all of that, I actually was believing at the end that Sam and Henrietta were like meant to be together. That I thought it did very well, which I didn't expect. That was an interesting character switch, which I don't see that happen in many films before. They have layers on characters where they're able to all of a sudden switch my feelings over what I want to see, especially when I'm rooting for a relationship. That was intriguing to me.
I don't think Henrietta loved Charles. I think she loved the past life that he represented.
I think so too.
That sounds fair. And I agree with the thought process, just that you expect Joseph Cotten to be the villain of the piece as it starts off, especially they're all so wary about, you know, don't accept an invitation to dinner from him. And, you know, he's got this prior history. So you expect that. And that is a little bit of a twist that all of a sudden he becomes somebody who you're actually rooting for in the movie. So give it some props for that. I think one of my biggest disappointments, well, there are several levels of disappointment, so I don't want to rate them. But one of the things I was disappointed with is this is a movie that takes place in Australia in the early 1800s. So one, I expected it to be more of a period piece than just, hey, they're wearing old-timey outfits, which is all I really felt we got as far as period piece. And I also wanted more of the culture and what goes on there than, well, it's a prison colony and you don't ask them about what they were in jail for. Like, that's really all I felt we got about Australia. And I think there could be so much more richness to this movie as far as that goes. And that was one of my levels of disappointment beyond the other things that I mentioned.
I don't know. I felt we got some good insight into how a civilization like that might be set up and work in terms of the, you know, I can essentially go and buy you recently freed convicts with work permits, and I control those work permits, and I can dismiss you at any time, and dismissing you means that you go back to the workhouse, right? And in terms of the, you know, how someone who was an ex-convict was viewed versus someone who wasn't, I mean, a lot of the final act hinges on if Sam's innocent of the murder, this second charge, I don't want to say it's nothing, but it doesn't have the dramatic consequence that it has if he's guilty of the first crime that he was imprisoned for. Well, so I felt like we did get some view into it from like a legal perspective.
Maybe I'm wrong, because obviously, despite my advanced years, I was not around in the early 1800s, but I expect that a country that is a continent, that is a prison colony, to be a much more rough atmosphere than what we get as far as, you know, oh, he's released and now he's, you know, he's rehabilitated and he owns this home and they're having a party and, you know, they have this whole staff of people taking care of them, and one of them is a manipulative little bitch. You know, I expected more than that. I really feel like I didn't get the threat of what life would be like living on a prison colony country.
I think you wanted Quigley Down Under.
Probably. I wanted something closer to that, yes, honestly. I wanted something closer to Crocodile Dundee than what I got.
Yes.
I did like that they played off that Sam did not just fit back into society and was not accepted. Because, yes, he's successful in the sense that, you know, financially he's sound. He's got a beautiful home. He does have people working for him, which is, you know, a sign of success. But for everything that he's achieved, he's bitter. And I mean, that's why the shift was something to me that was very surprising, because very early on, Sam comes off as a guy who is shady and he's not nice. And to be able to turn him into a sympathetic character, I did think that that was interesting. He had every reason to have the chip on his shoulder because, man, when his name comes up, everybody who's in high society is tipping the nose down to him. They don't want him a part of it. You should stay away from him. You shouldn't do business with him. If you do, we're going to ostracize you because of it. And that part, I thought, with Sam was, there were parts of this that I needed in order to latch me onto the film, in order to get, you know, like with any film, I want to get to the end. But I need those things that make me feel attached. I thought what they did with Joseph Cotton's character, that part really stuck out for me. He played a very good role in the way that he portrayed the character, because he was not likable in the beginning, and to be able to switch that way, I thought was impressive.
Go ahead. The only other thing I'll say, kind of, and I'm not trying to change how you feel, Paul, you know this, but the only thing I'll say to kind of counter your expectation is this was set in Sydney. So it is set in the major capital of the colony. So, you know, colonial American was rough and tumble, but, you know, Boston and New York were different from, you know, the outer reaches of Virginia. So
I think that this really could have been a great film with a director who had passion for the story. Hitchcock admits this was an ego piece. It was a symbolic victory to get Ingrid Bergman. He talks about having images of the photographers taking pictures of he and Bergman coming off the plane in London more than he had clear mental images of what the story was going to be. So when he's not super passionate, Michael Cotton referred to it as under corny crap while they were filming, which didn't go over well. He was doing the 8 to 10 minute takes he'd already tried in Rope, which we haven't discussed yet. But there's some really long camera takes in this, which makes the film feel slower. This is one of the cases where he made choices that didn't fit the story. And it turned out to be such a financial flop, it was hard to see for years, because the bank that funded it repossessed it. The bank said, yeah, you did not pay off your loan for this. We own the negative now. And it didn't turn a profit until the bank sat on it. They sat on it for a couple of decades and then re-released it as like a lost Hitchcock when his career was peaking again, because he had had, both he and Bergman had a couple flops in a row here.
See, one of the things about the way this played, and I think it goes to do with the experimental nature of the, the long takes, is it felt to me in its presentation and in the performances, and I think this was negative, as if it was a stage play being filmed. I didn't see the nuances to the performances. They felt a little over the top. And I've come to accept that in a stage play, you need to do that to an extent, that you need to emote a little bit more. People in the back seats can kind of pull in what you're doing. But, you know, a little bit of subtlety is lost on stage plays as compared to film. I think that seemed to happen in this movie. I really thought the performances were a little melodramatic.
I'm going to agree. There were a lot of melodramatic performances in this. Honestly, I think this might have been better had it been treated as a silent film. There are some beautiful shots in here, right? Some of them are gorgeous. He's got the scope, especially when they land in Australia. Those are the images I remembered when you see it. But you could strip the soundtrack out of this film completely, stick in intertitles that rewrite the dialogue, and make it a better movie.
To your point on that,
I would agree with that. That's an interesting thought.
Yeah. Well, especially with, I think some of the acting talent here were doing such visual displays of the motion, you know, especially when you're thinking of Margaret Leighton as Millie. I mean, she had a visual presence that was there, and especially during various moments, various peak moments for her character, where you saw a shift in her face visually. You're right. This would have worked very well, I think, as a silent film because of the way that the actors were portraying the characters. I think that would have been, I would like to see that film.
See, when it comes to the performance, before we start to record, Joseph Cotten came up in our conversation, and we were pretty much in agreement that he's one of the actors out there that, even if he's in a movie that doesn't live up to his level, you always seem to get a top-notch performance out of him. And I mean, he was clearly a Hitchcock guy, because I don't even know how many times, probably 6 or 7 times he even appeared on Alfred Hitchcock Presents. And then all these movies. And between Alfred Hitchcock and Orson Welles is where my love of Joseph Cotten's performances comes from. But even he, you know, he seemed to be very, it was almost like John Lovett's actor character from Saturday Night Live to me, where he is, you know, just blurting out his lines where it feels like he's not thinking about what he's saying. It feels to me like he's, you know, like he's reciting memorized lines. And that is not what I expect from Joseph Cotten ever. So you take that, you take the person who I feel most strongly favorably about, and I feel that it was a negative performance. And then I am in the minority in that I have never been a huge Ingrid Bergman fan. She's okay for me, but she did, like, I didn't see the allure that she presented as an actress that other people seem to feel, you know, oh, she was so beautiful, she was this, she was that. It's all lost on me. I don't really get that. And she actually seems, I was wondering if maybe if this is when she was pregnant with Isabella Rossellini, because she seemed a little like wearing very bulky outfits, and I mean, I guess it's the fact that she's supposed to be drunk most of the time, but she just didn't do it for me in this movie. I'll give you Margaret Leighton. I think she was the highlight of the movie, frankly.
Yeah, this is a film, they think one of the reasons it did not do well in the box office is because it was released just after her affair with Roberto Rossellini had been revealed to the public. So I don't know if she was pregnant yet, or if the pregnancy was, maybe it was there, but not public knowledge, but the affair had been going at this point.
Maybe she had given birth shortly before. I don't know. And I don't mean to criticize for that. I mean, it's, you know, you get pregnant, you get pregnant, it's fine. But just she, like the outfits almost seemed, it almost felt like she was wearing a winter coat made into a dress.
Her character was pretty pivotal for me, and what she did in this, because the part that at a time where I needed something to intrigue me in this, seeing how easy it was for her to, because of circumstance, to manipulate Sam with the relationship, the growing relationship between Charles and Henrietta, and I agree that a lot more of that was rooted in the fact that they have a shared history together and they're reminiscing about the past. But she really did, I think, a great job at portraying the manipulator. I was looking at some of the trivia in this piece. It's funny that Margaret Leighton and Michael Wilding, at some point in time, they eventually got married. But they played off each other very, very well. I like that he caught on very early on that there was something about her and didn't like the way that Henrietta was being cared for. And she played into that growing interest between them. Even with the bedroom piece where he climbed up on the, you know, the trestle and got inside of the bedroom, the door was locked. And he was, while he was definitely smitten with her, there wasn't anything that bad going on at that point. Boy, did she take, she kicked that up to 11. And I thought that part, she played a, this evil kind of manipulative, you knew that she was interested in Sam. That part I liked. I mean, there was some character moments in there in a film where I should be drawn in by the overall global story, but there were some character moments that I think, you know, if you were asking me, what did you enjoy about the film? Some of the character moments in there I thought were well done. But I think that's the acting talent that was in this. You know, I'm at certain points in time going, hey, let's
well, and I'll, I like the way, and there's an untold story there, but I like the way she had Winter the butler under her thumb. Like, Winter knew that something was going on, but didn't, like, was not brave enough to tell Flusky about it because he was scared of Millie.
Yeah. And he was actually part of a setup, you know, especially with the bottles and everything. When she was starting to become lucid, and she manipulated him and then threw him under the bus.
Yes,
and stuff like that. I was really quite. I was like, okay. So I mean, there are elements of this that I enjoyed. That I think if you would. It's funny. I would love to see Blaine's silent film that we were talking about, because I think there are some things that could have been cleaned up in this. And there were some elements that I thought could be quite interesting.
And I'll call it out, Sean, because I wouldn't be who I am if I didn't. Winter was played by Jack Watling, who to Doctor Who fans was Edward Travers during the second Doctor's run. His daughter was Deborah Watling, who became one of the companions on the show. So,
okay. Speaking of daughters, I checked here a moment ago, and Ingrid Bergman gave birth to Isabella Rossellini in 1952. So she is definitely not yet pregnant, at least with that child.
Unless it was a record gestation period.
Yeah. As in, like, beating the record of an elephant, yes.
Well, you know, I'm going to criticize... And I feel like that's what my role today is, just criticize. But I'm going to criticize the wardrobe people because they didn't make her look like somebody, you know, I think her character is supposed to be somebody who the viewer is supposed to kind of understand the allure that this is a love triangle and that, you know, we have Michael Wilding and Joseph Cotten both kind of in love with her. And I know that's not just a physical thing. But when you add in the lack of wardrobe to make her more alluring, and then the fact that she's supposed to be drunk all the time, I'm not sure. I'm not seeing the connection there on any level. I mean, you can understand Joseph Cotten because there's a long history that they've been together, but I don't get Michael Wilding, even though they have a past history.
Yeah, I really wonder how much of this performance is because at this point in her career, Bergman just wanted to pick up the scale, right? She was coming off of Joan of Arc and she wanted each film to be bigger than the last. So she signed off on this because she'd already worked with Hitchcock on Rebecca. You know, she felt that he could make a big film. It was a chance to go back and film in Europe again. So there's a lot of other appeal, but she was trying to do the upscale. So I'm wondering, how much of her performance is she just didn't want to be seen as the slobbering drunk, because aside from her introductory scene, I found out when she was supposed to be drunk more because others describe her that way than because of her performance. Like, she wasn't making acting choices consistent with the dialogue.
And I think they visually cleaned her up more when she was supposed to be more lucid. You know, you actually see her more made up, her, you know, her hair's done better. But I agree with you on that end. The costuming piece was, I think, an interesting criticism because they made such a big deal out of her gown that her dress that she was going to be wearing to this event. And I was like, really? That's the one we're making it? Like, he picked this out and we're going to make a big deal off of that thing, huh? So, which I don't normally do. But I was like, she looked good. I mean, in the sense that very clear makeup had done their job and made her look like she was more presentable to be at an event and like she belonged there. And I think for the average viewer at the event, they would look at her as being somebody who belonged there. But I did not necessarily think that the outfit was one where everyone should be going gaga over.
And Blaine, I think you meant either Spellbound or Notorious instead of Rebecca.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm going to give a little kickback on the performance because I want a drunk performance to be a little bit more subtle. I don't want her to be up there and be Forster Brooks, you know. So what you want to see is, you know, she's a little unsteady on her feet. She's slurring her words a little bit and she's kind of taking time to carefully think of her words because she's got a little bit of a foggy head. But I don't want it to be, you know, that she's stumbling all around like a, you know, again, like Forster Brooks.
Well, and my impression was, and I, this may be me adding to it because of the climax of the film. My impression was that Millie was slipping something like laudanum in the alcohol. So it was more than just alcohol. It was also a narcotic involved.
Yeah. She's been the poisoning or the, you know, I think initially it was keeping her in that state.
Yeah. Yeah. She was definitely feeding the addiction for her own purposes. Like Millie was, I think she was probably the most effective character on screen. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I mean, yeah, it's supposed to be a love triangle, and you think Ingrid Bergman's character is supposed to be picking someone. I didn't see signs of struggle between them. Like, I could have seen her, like, it didn't seem like she was going to go, oh, is it going to be this guy or that guy or this guy or that guy? I didn't see a lot of hemming and hawing. This could have easily gone to, like, a Chasing Amy type ending had it been made in another decade. Hmm. But I didn't see that struggle. The character who I saw was really making things going. The one who was most likely to engage me was Millie.
Yes. She also didn't let there be...
She was the most compelling character by far. Yeah.
She decided, though, what the story actually was as far as for Sam. It wasn't any of the... It wasn't really the deep actions of Henrietta and Charles. There are some criticisms you could have of, because clearly Charles was making the moves. And that was definitely a thing. Millie took full advantage of that, but she was definitely driving this ship along the way, especially with what she was doing with some of the women in the kitchen, you know, and the beatings, and Henrietta tried to overcome that. And initially, and she found a way to push her back into her insecurities, push her back into alcohol. Millie was totally the master manipulator in this. She did play a good role. Mm-hmm. Cause I feel like that was the continuity thread that I was following through it. That made this whole thing pretty interesting. And when Sam, you eventually want Sam to catch on and you want Sam to have a reaction. So for Joseph Cotton's character, if you don't have Millie there, you know, his character doesn't turn, you know, we don't get the feeling of, oh my gosh, I want him and Henrietta to go. And I didn't see that coming. I want him and Henrietta to go off together. If you don't have Millie, you don't get that feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For how little relative screen time she had, she was the driving force of pretty much every significant plot element. Mm-hmm. The rest is just, you know, everybody knows the secrets buried in their past, when except the audience. And when will the audience find out the bits that they are deliberately not talking about?
And again, as I said earlier, it didn't really feel like that much of a secret to me. It seemed to be pretty obvious what their hidden secret was. And I don't think that's because I'm such a brilliant investigator or anything like that. I think it just, it wasn't really, you know, a big plot point where you'd say, oh my God, I don't, you know, I'm shocked to find out that they had an affair. And or that rather that she's the killer. Oops, yeah. Did I just spoil the whole movie?
Yeah. Well, it's because, I mean, like I said, there's the secret, but there's no mystery. There's no detective work, right? It's not like the next Hitchcock we're going to talk about where you have the man on the run who's, you know, been misidentified and he's got to solve this mystery and figure out why they're after him, who they think he is, and, you know, ends up undoing the evil plot. Don't want to name that film until closer to the end, but I guarantee you, I think all, by the sounds of this conversation, all four of us are going to give that one a higher rating than we're going to give this one. Mm-hmm. This is just, I felt more pedestrian than I'm used to from Hitchcock. It's a by the numbers. Mm-hmm. He was clearly looking at, you know, what film can I make that puts these names on the poster and not what, how can I tell this story in a way that's going to grab the audience? I just didn't see the attention to the storytelling details. He even regrets who he got in as script writers. He wanted his buddy Hume Cronin, who was incredibly articulate, a great speaker, didn't have a lot of experience screenwriting. And another one, Brady, I think, was the other guy. And he realized, you know, he was a well-renowned playwright. But he realized when the film came out, oh yeah, this guy always has great first and second acts, but the third act falls apart. They all have weak endings, and now his film does too. So he thinks there was the potential to make it great. And I'm seeing him point out flaws, including in himself. Like this is a flawed movie. It was only really strongly received in France. So the French critics were very positive. They put it in his top 10 of his filmography when they did French critic polls. I would not have expected that.
No.
I mean, as we said, the way I arranged this list, I sorted Hitchcock films by popularity and we're alternating between the top and bottom half. And this is in the bottom half. I've also looked at the average ranking and seen how far away are they. So, you know, if his highest rated film is also his most popular film, well, that would make sense. So looking for hidden gems, this is not a hidden gem. It's the bottom half of his popularity and the bottom half of his ratings. They're very much in line.
When I watched it, I was aware that there were critics out there who put this high, even though the majority didn't. So I was honestly looking to see what it was that caused them to rate it so highly. And I kept coming up empty on that. You know, during the movie, I was struggling to keep it on, and my wife was watching it with me, and she made a comment at one point, well, you have to keep it on because, you know, you got to review it, right?
Yeah, this is one, from what I've seen of things like the Cahiers du Cinéma and the other French critics that showed up in my film studies class from this era, the French critics put a lot more emphasis on cinematography than critics in other parts of the world. And I think that may be what elevated it. Because like I said, it is beautiful. I can't think of a frame of this film where I say that could have been filmed better.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's parts that could have been performed better. There's parts that could have been written better. But if this is the script and these are the performances that you've got, I don't think you could make it look any prettier than they did.
I still think the problems with the script are the biggest problems, but then also, again, I said, you know, the performances were a little over the top, and I think that might be, again, because of the recording, you know, the filming style of the long takes. And I thought, I guess it's time we could get to I thought the score was very dramatic and unnecessarily so.
Yeah, I would agree. It's just, to me, this felt like everyone said, hey, let's make a movie with stars and not let's make a great movie. It just, the production focus was not balanced properly. And the film suffered.
I would agree that that's a very good description of it.
Sounds like we may be running out of comments. One other thing I have to say, like 5 minutes in, I was searching Michael Wilding to see if there was any blood relation between him and Alan Cumming, because had you told me that Wilding was Cumming's grandfather, I'd have believed you. I could find no connection, but it was just an observation I had that distracted me at first. It's like, is he related to Cumming? Because, man, their faces are similar.
Yeah, that's an interesting thought. But they did have a similar look. And I looked at Wilding's filmography, and I was not familiar with him. And he's been in some things that I've seen, but I don't remember him from them.
Yeah, it sounds like he didn't particularly take to the Hollywood lifestyle. So when they got married, and Margaret Leighton, who played Millie, when her career was more successful, he was quite happy to be the homemaker of the pair and go into retirement, which is unusual for the 1950s when they both had careers. So,
all right. I guess we can rate this. And to be totally honest, I finished watching it and I was torn between Psycho 3 and Psycho 4. There was no point where I considered this as Psycho or Psycho 2. As we've kind of hit on, I don't really see a lot of strengths in this movie. And there was a point where if we weren't reviewing it, I would have turned it off because it just was not capturing my interest. So I'm going to give it a very reluctant Psycho 4. I just didn't do anything for me, frankly.
I'm going to give this one a Psycho 3 because just the only place where I think we're at a different place is I enjoyed my time with this. It's not one that I would sit there and go, wow, you've got to go see this Hitchcock movie. I'm not in that place at all. But I enjoyed some of the things they did with character that I mentioned in this. And I did not, this wasn't a trudge for me to get through, which for me, if I'm going Psycho 4, it's got to be like, where you're at, Paul, where it was a chore for me to get through the film. And I didn't have that experience. I liked the movie. It's not a love. It's not one of those things where, I would say for the character pieces, and it's funny, Blaine, you said something earlier that I think maybe matches what drew me to it. You mentioned the stars being, you know, it being more about stars than necessarily even perhaps the story. And I might be poorly paraphrasing you, but I think there were character moments where certain stars interacting and what they were trying to do with their scene grabbed me, and I wanted to see more of some of the things they were doing there. I did like Joseph Cotton Sam's arc, just because that surprised me. I did not see, if there's one thing I didn't see coming in this, it was liking Sam at the end and rooting for him to get the girl. And that part, I think, was something that kind of kept me interested in this film, seeing where that was going. I did not, that was a twist at a time where I needed it, because otherwise I'd be in the place where I didn't enjoy the film. And I figured that was one of the things that kept me going through it, was the shift away from Michael Wilding's character to Sam. Because I was kind of done with him after Michael Wilding got shot. I was kind of like, I need something else at this point. And what they were doing with Ingrid Bergman and Joseph Cotton, I thought was really good there.
I'll go next because I think I'm breaking the curve for everyone. I'm actually giving this a Jaws 2. I really liked the performances. I found it really atmospheric. I agree with everyone. This isn't an engaged Hitchcock, but a checked out Hitchcock is still better than most directors. I agree it's not living up to its potential. This could have been the perfect mashup between Jamaica Inn and Rebecca, and then I think it would have been the film that Paul wanted. But I'll definitely see it again. And it may be my Doctor Who bias. I tell my wife if a film's got a monkey or a Doctor Who tie-in, it's halfway there to greatness. This film has two, so that may be a part of it. But it's a Jaws 2 for me.
And in my case, like Sean said, I like subverting the expectations for Sam characters. I liked Millie. And I like much of the cinematography, although it would have been better served by having close-ups during the dramatic moments rather than keeping the mediums for the long takes. So when I turned it off, I was going, okay, is this a Psycho 3 or is this one of the weakest Psycho 2s? And then when I realized I had watched this during the pandemic lockdown and had no memory of it whatsoever.
Wow.
That I figured, yeah, that's not a Psycho 2. So I'm landing on 3.
Right.
And, so we average at Psycho 3.
Where's Alfred? Yes. Yeah. For our Where's Alfred portion of the show, I did not see him, and I looked up afterwards, and I found out he actually appears twice. In this movie. Mm-hmm. Did anybody see him while they were watching it?
Nope.
I did not, which is rare.
Yeah, I actually did. They're not brief cameos, and he's not even facing the camera the whole time. Or they're not long cameos, and he's not facing the camera the whole time. So yeah, a little past the 2-minute mark, he's in the town square with the governor's speech. Again, back to the camera, blue coat, brown top hat. So I wasn't sure about that when I looked up to confirm if that was him. The later one, just after the 12-minute mark, when he's one of the men on the steps of the government house, is the one I caught and was confident. I thought, so the first time I thought, oh, is that the cameo? It's, you know, it's hard to spot him, but it's the right shape and size for Hitchcock in this era. So that was confirmed later. And then, yeah, the one I was confident, it's like, oh, the 12-minute mark, I'm like, oh, there it is. And then when I checked the list to confirm, it's, no, he really was both. So, yeah, this is probably in his more subtle cameos and also early in the film. So not his earliest cameo. But, I mean, it's, I'm here as early as you can argue whether it is a cameo or not, because he just flat out introduces the film. But we'll get to that.
So
yeah, speaking of things we'll get to.
That's what I was going to say. Boy, you missed a segue.
Yeah. So going through our list here, we're actually going to put pause on Hitchcock. And I'm not going to bury the lead on this one either. We are also alternating with Kubrick in sequence. The next one we have coming up is, I think, Kubrick's weakest feature film, also his first feature film, Fear and Desire.
Mm.
After that, we return to Hitchcock with North by Northwest. So I don't see any of us giving that one Psycho 4. Or probably not 3, but we'll see what happens.
I've mentioned in the past that North by Northwest is my favorite Hitchcock film. So you can just kind of take from there where you think I'm going to land. But yeah, you know, I've never seen Fear and Desire, and I'm going to have to give it a shot and see what I think. But, you know, this crew will get together again in the not too distant future, and we'll cover that. And if you're interested in giving it a preview yourself, please do. And this way, maybe our discussion will be even more entertaining than it already is, which it's hard to believe that that could even happen. But thanks, guys, for coming on. I appreciate your time, as always, even when we review a movie that doesn't quite hold up to our expectations. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in to listen, and we'll catch you next time. Bye-bye.
Eddie. I don't want to see you. I don't want to see you ever again. I couldn't do what you told me. I'm back home and tell them I died.
They're talking about it.
Go back to Ireland.
I'll leave Hattie Flusky in this beautiful place. This beautiful room.
I don't think much of it.
Come on now. I must get up.
Oh, what should I be getting up for now? I mean, no good to any living soul. Well, I'm on my head and my heels.
Well, that's better, isn't it?
No, it's not better.
Yes, it is. Ever so much better. You're standing on your feet. You must always stand on your feet. You must never give way.
Oh, I am no credit to you, darling.
Yes, you are. At least you will be. I've never been serious about anything in my life before, but I'm serious now. You must have courage.
I had courage long ago, but I lost it.
Thank you.
Alice's horror. This is not the way of it at all. I'll do my best, but this is not the way of it.